Javier Benson, good evening. I just want to give a short introduction to our speaker tonight. In the 19th century, at the same time that Ashkenazi rabbis, most notably the Chatam Sofer, took a stance, the famous stance, Chadash Asumin HaTorah, anything new was prohibited from the Torah, in reaction to the Reform Movement. During the same time, in the 19th century, the rabbis of Sephardic lands continued with the kind of open-minded philosophy and spirit that of convivencia, of living together, that they inherited from medieval Spain. The 20th century brought the meeting of these two worlds, both on the streets of the Lower East Side and in the kibbutzim of Israel. And for some reason, the Ashkenazi majority, with their more so-called sophisticated culture, European culture, dominated the Jewish voice, and even the Sfaradim themselves forgot their own heritage. Joseph Mozeri has taken upon himself to recover the writings of these rabbis, and it's a great honor for us to be able to hear and speak tonight about some of that.
Thank you. God, really want I'm sorry? Yeah, might as well give them up now. The subject of tonight's lecture is the approach of our Sephardic Hachamim to modernity. How do Sephardic sources bear upon contemporary halakhic issues? The purpose is twofold. To examine significant aspects of the methodology of these Hachamim, and to illustrate this methodology with actual case studies of halakha l'maaseh according to these Hachamim. Obviously, we are not here tonight to decide halakha l'maaseh for any of us, because just to look at one or two case studies of individual Hachamim would do total injustice to the methodology of the Hachamim that we're talking about. It's also important to remember what we can gain from learning about these Hachamim and how we could bring this forward into the Pesach Halakha of our own 21st century. Sephardic Halakha methodology is related to the place of Halakha within the Sephardic tradition and its specific function. In addition to Halakha, Sephardic tradition recognizes another realm, dealing with the ideology, religious views, mores, and attitudes of the Jewish people. For the Sephardi, the bond giving unity to the Jewish people is halakha, not a particular ideology, as opposed to the Ashkenazim, where there has to be a general ideology holding people together, and not halakha. Realizing that, we can now gain a better insight into the particular dilemma of the Sephardic Posek. On the one hand, halakha, as a political expression of the Jewish people, cannot be abrogated or altered by any individual. On the other hand, if halakha is to be effective, it must address itself to the issues of the society and reflect the concerns and values peculiar to the specific historical situation. How is the posek to arrive at a halakhic decision that is true to tradition and yet comes to grips with the specific historical and social dimensions peculiar to modern times? Sephardic halakhic methodology is directed towards the solution of this dilemma. There are two levels to this method. Number one, there is a need for the Hacham to master the entire rabbinic literature available on the subject. He must know it all in order to begin to understand from what aspect to approach the subject at hand. Only then can he decide upon that specific situation. As we know, the Perat is meaningful only within the Kirat. Accordingly, there is a need to master both the classical rabbinic text and the post-rabbinic text. We know from our great Hachamim that we will be studying that they looked even to Aharonei Aharonim, to the very last person who dealt with the subject, even if it was their own student. They would look at their teshuvot on their subject and deal with that as well. For the Sephardic posek, to overlook an opinion or a source pertinent to the subject would render the decision faulty. The second level of this method is that it means that the ideas and legal opinions must be understood within the proper historical context. One must first grasp the function of the legislation in its original historical context in order to evaluate its position in the new historical situation. For that, I ask you to look at your sheets, and you'll find on page 2, there's an item listed as item number 4, a quotation from Hacham Yehuda ibn Bulat. This Hacham left Spain in 1492 and was appointed as a Dayan in Turkey. He says here, "It seems to me that in matters of prohibitions and enactments, they, if they were worthy, the Aharonim can assemble and abrogate the words of the Rishonim." This is a very powerful statement. The Aharonim can do away with what the Rishonim said. This does not mean, God forbid, that they should deliberately set themselves to oppose the early authorities. However, this is the effect of the times that as a result of the different causes changes its designs, and what was beneficial to the Rishonim is harmful to the Aharonim. There is a principle agreed by all that no decree can be passed on the community if the majority of the community cannot endure it. This is not something new, something that was made up recently. This is something we're reading that's already 500 plus years old. And it's not something that was forgotten by our Hachamim. If you look, go back to page 1, you will see Rabbi Eliyahu Hazan, almost 350 to 400 years later, talking about the same ideal. I prefer to read it in the Hebrew. Ubehiyot. HaTorah HaKedosha Nittena Lebnei Adam Gishmiyim. The Torah was given to physical human beings. Ve'adolim Ve'chol Temura. And they're always subject to different changes. Ve'chalfu Ta'aitim Ve'zemanim. Any times of changes in time. HaMoshnim Ve'gezerot. Whether it be the rules or the decrees. HaTipa'im Ve'muzagim. Whether it be nature or climate. Whether it be in the state that they are in or in a different realm. Therefore, on purpose, the Torah is written in a hidden manner. It is written in ambiguity. And it can accept upon itself any true perush at any day and time. And Borei Olam set us forth to listen to the shofet, to the judge. Whatever will be established by the rulers according to the generation and according to the freedom that may be enacted at that time. And when the next generation comes to play, and there are new leaders, and they see that the people cannot hold up and cannot live up to the standards of the previous generation, he has the power, whether it be to add or to delete, to distract, to destroy, or to rebuild in a different fashion. As long as he does it with the fear of God on his face, any time. Indeed, the Torah of truth inscribed by God's finger engraved upon the tablets will not change nor be removed forever and ever. These Hachamim feel that the only way for the Torah to last eternally is through change. The Torah has opened itself up for change and has allowed change. And this was the path that they brought with them from pre-expulsion Spain, and this was the path that they carried with them into the Ottoman Empire and elsewhere. Based upon this, I want to tell you, we as Sefaradim, and those who follow the Sefaradi Tamidei HaChamim, we are not Orthodox. We're not. Orthodoxy is something that we never had, and you have to understand orthodoxy in its true historical context. In the 18th and 19th centuries, European Jewry underwent processes of enlightenment and secularization, accompanied by internal sociological and ideological tensions. How did this manifest itself among the people and rabbis of Europe? Reform Judaism. That was the immediate answer in Europe. The earliest religious response to modernity was anti-traditionalist in the body of the Reform movement. It denied the eternal validity of the halakha, which had until now governed all aspects of Jewish life, and instituted major changes in liturgical practice. The challenge of Reform and of the more general Jewish enlightenment, the Haskalah, did eventually stimulate a response from the champions of the traditional faith. What was this response? The earliest traditional response was one of uncompromising reaction, summed up in the rallying cry of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, better known as the Hakam Sofer. He took a line from the Mishnah and Orlah, and he reused it to his benefit. He said, "Hadash asur ha-Torah b'chol makom." Whatever is new is forbidden by the Torah in every instance. This reactionary stance remained the essential position for a large segment of traditionalists and became known as orthodoxy. Something that never existed anywhere in Judaism before early 19th century Europe. Orthodox leaders, in essence, declared that they were simply preserving and continuing the ways of life and the beliefs of pre-modern Judaism. They forced themselves into a position of denying the legitimacy of all modern innovations. They bound up the Torah in a manner which was never known among our Hachamim. In fact, according to Hacham Yisrael Moshe Hazan, this approach resulted in totally arbitrary and useless humrot that greatly contributed to the fragmentation of the Jewish community, thereby discrediting the office of the rabbinate. Now you may be saying, well, that was a reaction in Europe because they had modernization. We never had modernization. We were living in backward Arab lands, Turkish lands, Greek lands. We didn't have any of this. They didn't exist. And in fact, this is what they still teach in school, and it's a very popular myth that's taught in, you know, in Israel. The Sephardim never even had running water until they came to Israel. This obviously is not true. In 1830, France conquered Algeria. In 1831, Egypt conquered Palestine and Syria, and soon thereafter extended legal equality to non-Muslim inhabitants. In 1839, the Ottoman Empire followed suit with a declaration on civil rights. Jews of these lands were directly influenced by another factor as well, West European Jewry. These people in West Europe, they said, no, our brethren in Arab lands also, they're suffering. We need to bring them up. We have to go and help out the downtrodden Oriental Jew. So they also brought modernity with them. Modernity was there in our lands. Not only that, but the governments of the within the Ottoman Empire, whether it be Egypt, North Africa, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, all these countries, they wanted to modernize their states. They brought in new technologies, communications, transport, industry, agriculture, urban development. By World War I, Mediterranean Jews were significantly affected by modernity. And by the late 1940s, of course, everybody in the Middle East was quite modernized. Nevertheless, the typical response of the Sephardic rabbinic elite to these developments was very different from that of the European peers. Sephardic rabbis, therefore, cannot be characterized as orthodox in the correct sense of that term. I ask you to please look on page 1. You have the quote from Hassan bin Sion Meir Hai Uzi'ir. He was, of course, the Rishon Sion and chief rabbi of Israel from 1939 to 1953. And he says, מולידים דור דור שאלות ובעיות חדשות שדורשות פתרונן. In every generation, the conditions of life, changes in values, and technical and scientific discoveries create new questions and problems that require solutions. How does he respond to it? He says, אין אנו יכולים להעלים את עינינו משאלות אלו. We cannot turn our eyes away from these issues. ולא אומר, and to say, חדש אסור מהתורה. He's aware of this position of the Hakam Sofer and Orthodox Jewry. And he turns against it. He says, we cannot accept that position. That is not our way, and that is not the way to go. Kalomar, kol davar shelo niskar mefurash bedibrei kadmonim harei hu begedir ha'isur. Anything that is not mentioned is automatically forbidden. He totally rejects it. Umikol shekein she'en lanu ha'reishut lehorot bo heter mishikul da'atenu. And all the more so that we are not able to make, to render a decision from our own judgment. Velo leheshir otan kehan lechod amu mo besitu mo shekul da'hagin ho bo lefi da'ato. And to leave it open for every person to do as he decides. אבל זו היא חובתנו לפשפש בהלכות למיץ התום מן המפורש. It is our obligation, he says, to search and to delve into the words of Ha'achamim, to find ways to understand how to apply the way of the Torah to modern innovations. ובכל תשובותיי לא התכוונתי להקל או להחמיר מדעתי ובהכרעתי. He goes, in all my תשובות, my intention was never to be lenient or stringent. I didn't come here to just give my own opinion. My entire intention was to search for truth. Because right away, because so I'm not making up my own, I'm following the ways of our earlier rabbis. Shimimehem anu shotim. ובעולם אנו מוארים ובור קדוש זה היוסם מקור האור הגנות על האדם היירותי את עיניי. These are the people from the I walked in the light of the earlier masters, whose waters we drink and whose light enlightens us. With this holy light which issues from the source of the hidden concealed light, I illuminated my eyes. This was the way of the Sephardic Hachamim. In fact, his student, if you look on the top of the next page, Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv until 1998, when attacked by those who said, how can you make up all these innovative halakhot? This is his response. This is possible only because permission was given to Israel sages in each generation to renew halakha as appropriate to the changes of times and events. Halakha is dependent upon place and time, obviously, like we mentioned earlier. Only by virtue of this was the continuous existence of Torah in Israel possible, enabling Jews to follow the way of Torah. This is the only way, as we originally read with Rabbi Yehuda ibn Bulat. This was the way of the Hachamim. They brought it with them from pre-expulsion Spain. This is what they carried through. There is nothing so flexible as the flexibility of Torah. Nowadays we think of Torah as very rigid. It confines us that we can't do anything. But our Hachamim obviously look at it very differently. Torah is flexible, and it works with our day and age. It is only by virtue of that flexibility that the people of Israel, through the many novel and useful rulings innovated by Israel's sages over the generations, could follow the path of Torah and its commands for thousands of years. In essence, Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi is telling us that if we didn't take this stance, the Torah and Am Yisrael would have died out. On this vein, we obviously have to think about their approach, and that brings us to the beginning of some of the subjects I want to touch upon. Firstly, secular studies. You hear nowadays people screaming, no, we can only learn Torah, you can't have secular education in school, we have to shield, you know, our children from the bad ways of the world. This obviously was not the way of the Hachamim. Secular studies for Jewish students in the modern era is viewed upon as extremely important by our Hachamim. Indulge me while I run through a list of Hachamim of the past 150 years from throughout the Sephardic world who not only approved of secular education but expressed their interest in it and its importance, and some of them even to the point of stating that it is an obligation to teach our students history, math, business ethics, and the such. And we had in Yerushalayim Rabbi Chaim Nassim Abu Lafia, Rabbi Chaim David Hazan, Rabbi Yaakov Shaul Eliashar, Rafael Meir Panijil, Shlomo Moshe Haigagin, Moshe Malka. In Libya and in Alexandria, we had Rabbi Eliyahu Hazan. In Turkey, in Izmir, we had Rabbi Abraham Palachi. In Tunis, we had Abraham Hajjaj and Abraham Abu Qara. In Gibraltar, Hamis Hakim Walid and Yosef Arwas. In Hebron, Rahim Yosef Franco. In Rome, in Corfu, and in Alexandria, Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Hazan. In Crete, Abraham Iblagon. in Morocco, Ishaq Nahon, Ishmael Nahon, Shmuel Abu Afia, in Baghdad, from Abdullah Sumer, Yosef Hayim, in Serbia, Ephraim El Kilai, in Damascus, Ishaq Abu Afia, and Shlomo Sukari, in Beirut, Yaqub Bukai, in Halab, Hacham Aharon Shweta. We had Hachamim in all our cities, in all our countries at all times that were pro-secular education. In fact, we think about these rabbis that I mentioned. I mentioned Rabbi Yosef Hayim. We all know him very popularly as the Ben Ishhai. We think Ben Ishhai, we think, oh, this great Mekubah, we think Humrot, we think, you know, how could anybody like that be pro-secular education? Question was presented to him, Hacham, can we teach math and Arabic and commercial correspondence? His answer was most definitely. It's obligatory, you must teach it. If you want the students to get ahead in today's world and to understand their surroundings, they must learn it. So Mizvah to teach it to them, but please don't teach it to them in the Knesset while you're also teaching the Jewish studies. In fact, by other Sephardic Hachamim, his response was considered very mahmir, too stringent. Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Hazan said, no, this is the way of the Torah, so you must study in the Knesset. And not only study in the Knesset, but even if Goyim hear that there is such a Jewish school, let the boy come and let the boy study with the Jewish people in the Knesset as well. This is the importance of secular education to our Hachamim. Let's note the other aspect of it, the response of the Hachamim of Eastern Europe. In 1891, the decision of the heads of the Russian Yeshiva of Volozhin was to close down the institution rather than to agree to the inclusion of secular topics in the curriculum. Not only that, but in 1853, the rabbis of Jerusalem's Ashkenazic community decreed a harem and nidui to anybody who would send their children to the newly founded modern schools. Very different scope. Very different way of looking at things. Once you close everybody off to secular education, you close them off everything else that has to do with living in today's world.
Didn't the rabbis in Halab oppose the Alliance when it was first opened?
No, when it was first opened, they were very pro it. It was only later on when members of the Bnei Berith came in that they opposed it. Look at the early writings and the letters that they wrote that you could find in the archives of the Alliance, and you'll see they were very pro the Alliance in the early days. Speaking of secular education, that brings us forward to science. Obviously, this increased study and knowledge brought about modern science and technology. Hacham Rafael Haron ben Shimon, in a Teshuvah, where he spoke about allowing the striking of a match and turning on of electric lights on Yom Tov, says the following: new inventions of many types have proliferated in our times. For human technological ingenuity has increased as a result of knowledge gained by research into the basic elements of creation. New inventions, not even imagined by our forefathers, blossom forth daily. You can tell, he speaks about technological advances in a positive light. He likes it. We see that he's aware of the dependency of technological progress upon scientific research, and he regards this research not as antithetical to religion, but rather as an involvement in the understanding of creation. He was not alone in his position on electricity. Many other great Sephardic rabbis also allowed the use of electric lights in Yom Tov. As we mentioned before, Rabbi Uziel, he was one of the earliest ones to allow turning on electric lights in Yom Tov. Rabbi David HaKohen Sekli, Rabbi Yosef Mesas, Rabbi Mosfut Kohen, and our present generation, Hacham David Shilush of Netanya. Let's take a look at Rabbi Yosef Mesas. On, I believe it's your last page, page 4, you have a quote from Rabbi Yosef Mesas. In the middle of the page, section A. This is just, of course, a very, very short excerpt that he wrote much later in his life, and not the actual Teshuvah, where he deals with why he allows, electricity on Yom Tov. The person asked him a question as to why is there a difference between Sephardim and Ashkenazim when it comes to this halakha. And he, of course, says there shouldn't be any difference, but he begins as such. Haddavar Pashut, it's very simple. The Tam Ashkenazim hu mishum shechoshvim hadlakat ha-hashma biyom tov shehu nolad, ve-nolad asu biyom tov. They consider it giving birth, the turning on of electric lights. And he says, no, this is, you know, of course, Nolad is Asur in Yom Tov, and therefore will be Asur. He says, we, as the Haredim, say, Ve'anan Tamhinin HaBe'azir. We are bewildered by this position. Ve'anzin Nolad Kelad. Nothing's being created over here, nothing's being born new. He quotes Hotea Hashma Shabrahob and the Im Zerma Hashma Tamid. Ve'achotin Shabai Tamrikim. Ve'ayde Hatiyat Rafteah. Ve'achabirim Achotin Ve'azir Nifnas Hotea Bai. Ve'achabes Tokhat Gabia Ve'osish Al-Hibit. Very simple. Electricity is always there. It's going through the wires at all times. You just switch, you know, turning on the switch, and it's bringing the electricity forward. With the Gemara talks about it, if you have coals and you blow on the coals, and you know you have the fires are burning and it creates more of a fire, that's mutar because you're not creating something from nothing. And that's the basic approach of the Sefaradi Hachamim, that the fire is there within the wires, and that's what creates the light. Whether all the Hachamim agree with that or not, that's not what we're here to discuss, as I mentioned earlier. He basically ends off the Teshuvah, if you look 2-3 lines from the bottom of it. I've discussed it and I've argued with them on this point and about electricity, and they all agree, yes, I'm right. They're wrong and I'm right. The emet is that it is allowed. They already have gone into the habit of forbidding. They don't know how to, you know, how to say something is permissible now. He feels that they're just like pushing him off with that answer. They just, you know, they don't know how to deal with it anymore. Well, let's go one step further. Look at the top of the page. Look at the genius of Rabbi Yosef Mesas. When he was asked about using an electric menorah for the holiday of Hanukkah, he of course allows it, but he gets into a full discussion about the Beit HaMikdash and the menorah. And he says the following, Ve'od ani omer, Depashut ubarur, Shimhaya or her electricity, Masui bizman HaMikdash, Vaddai shebo hayum adzikiyah menorah. Says if electricity existed at the time of the Beit HaMikdash, 100%, no question about it, the menorah of the Beit HaMikdash would be an electric menorah. Mishum she'i efshar liyot she'en malay batkenu ha'cholin ba'olim gedolim shel or ha'shma'a liyakar hazeh. So it would be impossible. How are we going to fill up our own homes with this wonderful, this great electric light? She'um me'ayin dugma shel ma'ala. He compares it to the light of Borei Olam, of heaven. U'mebet Elohim ha'kadosh nadik b'shem zayit. But now, in God's house, this great holy structure that we have, we're going to light with a little bit of olive oil. שאפילו העניים הגירועים מועשים אותו בזמן הזה. That even the poorest of poor people would even consider such a thing to light their homes with nowadays. They hate it. ופשוט שממנו נדליק בבית האחרון שבנה ברבי מן אמן. And he says, point blank, in the third bit of Mikdash that we should speedily have nowadays, 100% according to his opinion, that's what we're going to have, an electric menorah. It's a very wild teshubah to think about. Three things can be learned from it. Electric light is modeled after a heavenly model. Me'ayin dugma shel ma'ala. This goes back to the Teshuvah Rabbi Yehuda Ben Shimon. Modern science uncovers sublime aspects of creation. These are the elements that Rabbi Yehuda Ben Shimon was talking about. He compares our homes and Beit Hashem. How could our homes be more advanced and brighter than Beit HaMikdash? We can't do that. That would be poking fun of the Torah. And third of all, it makes us think all about the extensive Torah and rabbinic literature regarding the structure of the menorah. Throughout the Torah, it uses all the details of the menorah. In the Mishnah, in the Gemara, later rabbinic writings, they all talk about the menorah has to look like this, and shaped like this, and the oil has to look like this, and the wicks have to be pointed sideways and backwards, and everybody gets into the whole thing. Reading this Teshuvah, now it seems that all these passages are only technologically contingent. The Torah is going into all this great detail, we understand from Yosef Mesas, because we have to understand the importance of bringing it up to the modern day, of updating our vision of what that menorah should be like. If our best light is electricity, that's what we use in the Beit HaMikdash. Beit Hashem must have the best, therefore the Torah is in essence commanding us to keep up with technology. After all this, who still believes Ahadash Asun HaTorah? Can he really take such a stance? Now you may all be thinking, well, okay, you bring one leniency after another after another. No, dealing with modernity does not mean leniency. It could be taking a more stringent position as well. We have on page 3 a teshuvah from Hakam Abdullah Sumeh. Hakam Abdullah Sumeh was one of the greatest rabbis of Baghdad from 1813 to 1889. Many Jews from Iraq moved to India and they would send him questions on a regular basis. And they sent him a question. They were asking him about what we know today about having the goy and kines to turn lights on and off and such. At the time they weren't using electric lights, it seems, from Tishubah, but they were using, you know, regular flames. And they mentioned that he opens up this Tishubah and he talks about the Tishubah of Rabbi Yaakov Popper, who was rabbi of Frankfurt from 1718 to 1740, in his book Shevi Yaakov. So over there, Rabbi Popper, of course, advocates that we must have a Shabbat goy. We must have a goy to turn the flames on and off in the Beit Knesset, because otherwise we'll run into too many problems. If we leave the flame on, we're in the risk of, you know, the Sefarim burning, catching fire, the building burning down, and then the goyim will come and say that the Jews burned down a building, even though it's their own, so they could harm the buildings of the goyim that are in the same area. And then the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews will also have to come and, you know, put out the fires themselves, and that's another sort of Shabbat, etc., etc. Abdullah Sumeh rejects the whole thing. If you look at the third paragraph, it starts Nimsa'ikar Tokef Hayatei Shaharab Shebi Yaakov V'Semech Shelo Mishum Kedbeh Kodesh V'Gam Halilot HaGoyim. Then he puts in a nutshell, this is the position of the Shevi Yaakov. But he rejects it. He says, but nowadays, Baruch Hashem, things have become a lot better here in the diaspora, in our day and age, in our places. Even in Europe, and even here in the Turkish Empire, in the Ottoman Empire. They're not going to go and create a ruckus and say the Jews did it on purpose, that they burnt the building down to burn down, you know, the homes of non-Jews that live around. Nobody would ever enter their mind that such a thing was done by Jews so they could hurt non-Jews. Not only that, but look at this, he says, basically, everybody has become equal. Jews, Christians, Muslims, we are all the same people. It's not the way it was before. And he says, it's not the Mechal Shabbat, if God forbid this happens and, you know, there's a fire. The Jew's not going to come by himself to put out the fire. Right away, the fire department's going to come. We live in modern day and age. You know, average Joe Schmo doesn't grab a bucket and a pail and go start throwing out fire. Pull it to the fire department. They know what they're doing and they come and do it. There's no problem. Then the Asman Mechabim Hadilika. The Imkan if he's there, called Elu Ta'amim Shalara Shibi Atob, Lashay Yechab, his man was there. Everything that he said does not apply nowadays. And he continues, of course, and you know, it all depends upon the time and the place, and if, you know, your situation over there in India is a situation where, you know, you have the problems of the Shibi Atob, then fine. Follow his opinion of having a goy come, you know, Shabbat night and turning out the lights and putting them on in the morning. But if you don't have the situation, do what we do here in Baghdad and leave the lights on. He wrote this to Shabbat in 1885. He still come to have fire departments and everything. No problem. He was living in modern day and age. And he didn't take it as leniency. He used it as a stringency in this case. Another effect of the day and age, as we saw, Abdullah Sumeh is talking about equal rights among people, that moves us into the area of women's suffrage. The right of women to vote and or to be elected. As you know, Israel was occupied by Great Britain, by the English, 1917, 1918. And the Jews that were living there at the time were engaged in internal deliberations to elect an assembly that would represent them, you know, among the new authorities. And the biggest controversial subject that came up was women's suffrage. Obviously, and not surprising in light of everything we said, Rabbi Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, who we know as one of the greatest Zionists, rejected the whole issue of women. No, women cannot vote. In pre-modern Jewish communities, women never had political rights. In our day and age, they should not have political rights as well. Not only that, we can tell from the Torah that women had not been accorded status in the biblical definition of Israel politics. They were never regarded as kahal or eidah. Only men were kahal or eidah. Women were never counted in the census. They were never listed in genealogical lists. No, we're not going to let women vote. Hafam bin Sion Nirhay Uziel, again, he looked at things very differently. Said, fine, let us grant. They're not kahal, they're not eidah, they're zero. Okay, women are zero. Make you happy, that's what we're going to say. But aren't they creatures? Weren't they created, the Selim Elohim? They have some sort of intelligence that they're created, the Selim Elohim, otherwise they don't exist at all. Aren't they going to be obligated as well to listen to the people that are going to make those decisions? Any elected official, the women have to listen to. They're obligated and bound by the same laws. That being the case, they have to have some say in the matter. He realized that the world was changing. He was very, very open-minded, Hacham, very well-read, and knew already that, already in Norway, I believe it was, in 1913, women's suffrage was a thing of the past. Women were there voting and electing and, doing it all. And, many other countries in Europe slowly caught on, and by 1920, I believe it is, it was, fact over here in the United States, in all states, women already were accorded the right to vote. His bottom line is, because women were created in Selim Elohim, and they were endowed with intelligence, that they must be expected to obey the elected leadership, and they must follow suit in voting for them. How can we, Am Yisrael, in Israel, we're supposed to be the light to all the nations? We see that the nations have already realized something and woken up and are doing, something that is what would seem to be more correct, and we're going to be the backward ones? He could not stand it. He went ahead with his position as opposed to others. Now, I could, of course, keep going on and on with more and more examples of different hachamim. Do you want me to? Where do you want me to take from here? Continue.
What are the topics?
I have lots of topics. I'll just mention a few of them, and then if you want me to get into it, we'll talk about it. I'll mention the first, Hacham Meir Waknin. Hacham Meir Waknin was, in essence, the first chief rabbi of this community. He was from Tibariya, and he came here prior to World War I to collect funds for Tibariya. And because of World War I, he got stuck here. Community was on the Lower East Side. They fell in love with him. Hacham, you're here, you're stuck, you're our rabbi. He was here for a good 4 or 5 years. And they loved him, and they wanted him to stay here, but he was dying to go back. But obviously, during those early days on the Lower East Side, they asked him many questions. He's one of the earliest Hachamim that we have that talks about electric timers on Shabbat. He deals with the issue, and he allows it. He was asked about running trolley cars on Shabbat. At that time, there were electric trolley cars and still horse-driven ones. The horse-driven ones, obviously, we have Mishnah Mefureshet, and he couldn't allow it. Electric ones, he said, as long as you have a way of not carrying your ticket to get on board, and you don't have to pay for it, you could use it. Obviously, I'm not going through all the details of how he arrived at his conclusion, but this is the open-mindedness that we're dealing with. The issue of using microphones on Shabbat. Hacham Yehuda Maslaton, originally from Damascus, later on a Beit Din in Cairo, he was asked about, can we use a microphone in Beit Knesset on Shabbat? He allowed it. The whole issue was about allowing it, and it was used. In fact, till I know from my father, till the day he left Egypt in 1961, they were still using a microphone every Shabbat, every holiday, even Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur,
they used it. Microphone. The Hazan, the rabbi, everybody used the microphone. Rabbi Yosef Mesas was asked by a rabbi, a Moroccan rabbi that was here in the United States in the early 1960s. Rabbi, we have a very big kinis over here, it's not like Morocco. You know, each kinis is the size of, let's say, the Hayez of a Shari Siyon. And I make a speech on Shabbat, I want to speak to Brit Torah, and they can't hear me all the way in the back. Can I use a microphone? The bar mitzvah. Use a microphone on Shabbat. No problem whatsoever. Hakam Maktub Abadi dealt with the issue of dishwashers. Okay, tons of people, can we use a dishwasher for meat and milk? Can we have to use it at the same time? We use it at different times. It's a modern innovation, you know. It's not something that we define Shulchan Aruch or Rambam or any place else. Nowadays you see people buying two dishwashers. No, you could use the same dishwasher, meat, milk, even at the same time. He dealt with it. Let's get even more modern. Nowadays you go to hotels, you don't have regular keys anymore. You have these electronic cards. What are you supposed to do on Shabbat? Lock yourself out of your room? Keep your door open and hope that you don't get, robbed? What do you do? None of the Al-Hakharim want to deal with it anymore. And you ask them, and I'm going to say point blank, even ask the rabbis in our community, whether you want to call them white, black, in between, you ask me the question, I don't know, I don't talk to you, don't ask me. We have in Netanyahu, we have Rabbi Shalush, he deals with it. You're in a hotel, what are you supposed to do? You're going to suffer on Shabbat? He goes, you have to do it, you use it. There's nothing happening over there. He says, whatever's happening, it's just a light emitting diode, it's a bunch of magnets and thing, and there's no actual, current that you're creating. He goes, he sat with an electrical engineer and he discussed it, that he deals with modernity and he finds a way to allow it.
Is that the battery type thing or is that the electronic?
He seems to be dealing with both and he has no problem with either one. It's not a light, it's a light emitting diode, it's not a real light.
It's a diode.
It's a diode, it's not a light.
It's not a light.
Exactly. Let's deal with the subject of... That's Rabbi David Shalush. God bless him, he's alive and well in Israel. He's the last of this old breed that we're talking about in my own community. No, I would still say Rabbi David Shalush is still the last of the old breed. Let's deal with the period of the Omer. The period of the Omer has always been a happy period for Am Yisrael. Only recently have we started hearing that the Omer is a sad time, and I'm not going to get into why it became a sad time, etc. But we all know we don't have weddings during the Omer. Rabbi Yitzhak Nissim, who was the chief rabbi of Israel after Rabbi Uziel, he allowed weddings on Yom HaAtzmaut. Yom HaAtzmaut is a holiday. It's a true holiday. It's a modern innovation, yes, but it's realness. It's a miracle. You could definitely have a wedding on it. Go have a wedding on it over here in Ocean Parkway. See what happens to you. Thank you. What else? You have Rabbi Eliyahu ben Amozeg. Rabbi Eliyahu ben Amozeg, we all know as a great commentator on the Torah, on Jewish ideals and thought. But he also, as all great Sephardic Hachamim, he was a halakhist. Number one thing about him, he was posek. And at his time in Europe, the fashion in Italy was to be cremated. People, that's it, that was the way. I'm dying, I'm going to fight off God. God thinks he's getting me, well, I'm going to get cremated and scatter my ashes and go see how you're going to deal with me after my death. People are, wise guys. And his attitude was, listen, we can't fight them off. If they're going to have this idea, we could try to teach them. But the question was posed to him, now what do we do? Do we bury these ashes if they're, if we could finally convince the people to bury them, or is this haram? Do we deal with the mourners at all, or we just ignore them and, not put them into Abidu because they're following the wishes of this deceased? And he deals with it. And he goes through an entire 27-page book that he wrote specifically on this question. And he says, let them do what they want. We're going to bury the ashes. He found a way to allow burying ashes. And he said, we as the Hachamim, we have to do our job. After they go, they'll deal with Borei Olam. That's between him and them. We don't turn them away from Judaism. because if we're going to turn them away from this little thing and not try to help them along, we're going to lose all these families as well. The stance of the Sephardic Hachamim was always very, very close to the people, thinking about the way people thought and using that hand in hand. Now obviously this is not only something that came as a non-reaction to this Hadash Asum HaTorah, or something that only came from that earlier quote that we read, you know, from 500 years ago. But this is also something that Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulay, the Hidah, he realized that he was a Shadar for Israel. Shadar, now we call them Shidihin. Okay, Shadar Shulchan Rabbanan. And he used to go out as an emissary for the Holy Land. Back then, only the greatest Hachamim were sent out. It wasn't just your average guy, okay, with a hat and a beard, you go collect some money for us. It was the greatest Hachamim that would leave their communities to go out to collect. And he encircled practically the entire Jewish world of his time. And he discovered something. He saw that the Sefer Adim, the rabbis of the Sefer Adim, clung to the quality of chesed, compassion, and they tended to be lenient in all their decisions. On the other hand, the Ashkenazi Hachamim followed the quality of Giburah, heroism, and therefore tended to be strict. The distinguishing characteristic of Sephardic sages was their commitment to chesed. The Sephardim always came down on the side of compassion. They thought about the people and they thought, how are we going to do things the right way, the way people would want, and the way that blends in with the society. In fact, Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi pointed it out when he was talking about the controversies between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai always tend to be strict and Beit Hillel always to be lenient. And the halakha, as we all know, then tend to be like Beit Hillel, to be lenient. He asks why. And after comparing numerous cases, he says that because they were more sensitive to human predicament and sympathetic to human weaknesses and inadequacies, and considerate of the difficulties of life which affected people's behavior. This is the way that we accepted from Beit Hillel, and this is the way that we follow. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, the Sephardim have suffered a certain loss of spiritual identity. We have developed a sense of inferiority in relationship to the Ashkenazim. Sephardic rabbis in Israel wear Ashkenazi garb. Right, Hafan? Why do you do it? Sephardic yeshivot are only Sephardic yeshivot by name, but everything about them falls straight into the Ashkenazi mold. Somehow, we have come to believe that the Ashkenazic insistence on Giburah, on heroism and strictness, is really more, quote-unquote, religious than the traditional Sephardic emphasis on chesed, compassion. Indeed, nowadays, to show compassion and leniency is often considered to be a sign of spiritual weakness. One who would seek a reasonable compromise is branded as a coward and as a compromiser. The Sephardic religious sensibility is of such vital importance to world Jewry that we find ourselves emulating other traditions and abandoning our own distinctive right. It's not fashionable to be a person of chesed, to stick up for chesed. And anybody who does is criticized. We all know it. The Sephardim can do a great service, not only to ourselves, but to the entire Jewish nation by returning to our spiritual roots. We must study the words of our Hachamim, and we have to stand together against extremism, because this extremism breeds hatred. Instead of appearing to be counterfeit Ashkenazim, Sephardic Hachamim should become Sephardim. Enough's enough. We have gone too far in the way of the Ashkenazim. It's time to come back home. Thank you. Of course. I'm not saying no. I only brought one example how the mindset of the Sephardi could be either strict or it could be lenient. but it follows in a path that always considers everything, and not, you know, you don't go straight ahead with blinders on. Anybody else?
This whole concept of Asir HaRab is a difficult one,
and you don't really find the Sephardic Hachamim dealing with it like the Ashkenazim, you know, who tell you, yes, you have to have one rabbi. You don't really find it, because the Sephardim, you know, were more cohesive, they mesh with each other, and the Hakam said so. The Hakam said, well, what was the Hakam in the place and the time? That's what they followed. They didn't have the situation that we have nowadays, that we have a zillion rabbis, each one yelling something else at us. You know, but they had no problem. They seemed to believe that, look, the search for the truth. Wherever you find the truth, that is the way to go. One Hakam could be correct on one issue, and another Hakam could be correct on a different issue. But of course, that could be correct on a different issue. But of course, you know, I'll leave it to you to decide between you and your rabbi.
But we cannot make gezerot either. And gezerot that are made in the modern age are not gezerot. According to the Hakamim, gezerot were only made back then in the time of Mishnah, basically.
How do you change
the gezerot? If it's a Mishnah, gezerot, you cannot change it.
Right.
Whatever it may be. But nowadays we have no right to make up gezerot. You see people doing it left and right, making up gezerot, but we are not allowed to. Rabbinic literature is replete with many, many, you know, rabbis saying that it is forbidden for the rabbis of our day and age to make up gezerot.
Yeah, but let's say gezerot was made 200 years.
Well, that's not true. If you look at Rabbi Ibn Gulat and look at Rabbi Eliyahu Hazan, they say straight up, if the gezerot there that doesn't work with the place and the time and the people, and the people cannot adhere to it, the rulers, the leaders of the community, the Hakamim, have to change it. These are not my words, these are the words of the Hakamim. It's very different than what we're used to hearing. I agree with you, it's very hard to swallow. It's hard to swallow because you're not used to it. But what you're used to hearing would have been very hard for your father, Alav HaShalom. Your father was Talit Hassan, I remember him very well. How do you think he would feel about what's going on? Thank you.
Do you have an example of that in the early days
of the community? Of what? Doing away with the Gezerah?
Yeah, doing away with
the Yeah, sure. I have a situation. Since you're talking about the early days. In Halab, of course. In Halab, of course, the meat was what we know today as Glah. Okay? Masah Halab. When the earliest pioneers were leaving Halab to come to New York, the United States, approximately 1900, they didn't find this smooth meat over here. They found regular kosher, and they didn't know what to do. And they sent back, they didn't have Hakamim with them over here, they sent She'ira to Halab. What should we do? And Hakam Yosef Sittehon wrote it to Shuvah, and it was endorsed by the chief rabbi at the time of Halab, Hakam Hiskiyash Betai, and he told him, straight up, you follow what is the manhag of your place and time. If the people over there are eating regular kasher, what they consider kasher, according to their rabbis and their rules, that's what you do. Eat that meat. He didn't put until. There's no until. I didn't see any until. And until, so nowadays it's changed, obviously. Because nowadays, you can't even find that meat unless you're looking for it. Everything has become a lot around here. I don't recall seeing any until.
Hey.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But in terms of also the Sephardim were halachic.
Yes, they were.
I'm sure that they used halachic principles.
Of course, I'm not getting into that because not everybody is on that level to get into that. If you want to have a private class, yeah, that's we could get into an actual teshuvah and we could break it down and look at, you know, the principles involved. In each case would be different, obviously. Anybody else? They as far as I know, in the old section of Halab, what's called the Bahsita, they did have an Eruv. What bearing that has on our Eruv over here, obviously, you know, they had nothing the size of Ocean Parkway, you know, they, small, narrow streets, obviously. you know, any pictures that I've ever seen or people that were there, you know, and have told me, they said the streets over there were very, very narrow. In Egypt, only in the old Jewish quarter of Cairo, but in Alexandria, Rabbi Abraham Abgziyat, who was the head of the Din under Rabbi Eliyahu Hazan, he proposed the making of an Iroub, and he wrote up a whole teshuvah about it, and he sent it to Yerushalayim, to Hassan ben Sion Pawinta, who was the Rosh Abdeddin of Yerushalayim, and he approved the plans, and the other Hakamim of Yerushalayim approved the plans, and then they wrote a follow-up on it, and it was all ready to go, but in the end, Rabbi Abgziyat moved back to Israel, and that Iroub was never put up. But the plans were ready, and the streets were wide, and no problem at all. Here we are.
You touched on the subject of prayer.
I think that's a whole different type of class. A whole different lecture. There's a lot of different things you could talk about. The development of prayer. It could be if else. How could you consider prayer stricter or not stricter? Our prayer is much longer, if that means anything to you. You want to call that strict or call it strict? I wouldn't know how to define that. I wouldn't know how to answer you then, I'll be honest with you. Number Il, Zuri. This was the position in the community until 25 years ago, 100%. All the rabbis of the community allowed burning lights on Yom Tov. Yes, 100%. 100%. Can you go there are different opinions on? Well, Chaim Yosef had his position. His initial position when he first wrote about it was very, very strict. Later on, he softened up a little bit, you know, saying that those who do it have something to rely upon. You know, we don't have to really reprimand him. No. Now, his initial teshuvah, it's not true, Zuri. You've never really read his teshuvah. You can't talk about Yehavidah. You have to talk about Yehavidah, his real massive teshuvah. That's his magnum opus. And you'll see over there that in his teshuvah, electricity, he really doesn't really deal with the issues, unfortunately. And he tends to just want to side with, the, you know, this world of Ashkenazi Humrot on that topic. And I took to that on the one. But, you know, based upon everything we've read and that, your father and your grandpa and your rabbis all taught you to do that, I see no problem with you turning lights on Yom Tov. You know, you decide. I know you do it anyway. That's the issue of Minhag. That's more of the issue of Minhag. Even in the old world, you had Sephardim, you know, who refrained from certain things during the 3 weeks in different countries. Yeah. All right? Maybe four of us. Oh, we got one more. Yeah, David. We don't sing Arabic songs to Tefillah. We sing Arabic melodies. The Hakamim were very, very... Sure, it was always an issue, and the Hakamim were very pro it, because we were removing, the tum'ah of the music, and we were bringing it up in holiness. They had no problem with that, singing in Hebrew. As long as they're not singing in a foreign language, or singing lewd words and thoughts, they were very pro bringing that into the Tefillah. Thank you.
In medieval times, the rabbis and philosophers were always also medicine men and pharmacists. It's great that Jerry's continuing that ancient tradition. And we thank Jerry very much for reminding us, and we hope that you can continue to do such these things in the future. Thank you.